Hello, this is Carolyn Bilewski, and you're listening to The Other Side of the Table, Lessons from Creators, which was recorded at New York Comic Con on Friday, October 8th, 2010. The panel featured Jimmy Palmiotti, Raina Talgemeier, Brian J.L. Glass, Carlos Bede McNeil, and myself, and the panel was moderated by Joe Carabeo. We'd like to thank Dave Sim for donating the book Ultimate Cerebus, Guide to Self-Publishing, and I hope you enjoyed this panel. Thank you, and thanks for listening.
11:18. We're late by 2 minutes, so we have to really hurry on this one. But I want to be the first one to welcome you to New York Comic Con 2010. Yeah. Let's do an applause. Thank you. That was pretty awesome. And you know what? There's a lot of people, you know, in this world that can have a great idea, but not everyone can make it. And with that, I give to you the other side of the table. So I'm just going to start from closest to furthest away. We have the creator of Curls Studio, the Legouts, the Black Magic Tales, Miss Carolyn Bilewski.
Yay!
The one and only the creator of The Finder, Miss Carlos Field McNeil.
Yay!
What is that weird yay? I love it. Again. Mr. Mycelar.
Whoa, it's like a big screen up there. You didn't tell there'd be a big screen.
We have surprises.
That's right. I always wanted to say this, but this lady's work puts a smile on my face.
Yay!
Yay!
It's right there.
I'm guessing everyone knows who she is. Just yell it out. Miss Go Raina. Tell you
my. Yay!
I feel really far away from you guys.
Who are you?
Oh, my name is Joe Carabeo. I'm the Joe Carabeo. Exactly, so what you're going to get a peek here is a very spontaneous conversation about the other side of the table. There may be things that could be, you know, true, false, fun. We're just going to keep it loose. And I'm going to go do a little back and forth. I'm going to ask a couple questions, and if you guys have any question at all, feel free to either stand or raise your hand, and hopefully we'll see you, and we'll pick on you and make sure you have a great question. But also, we're giving away an awesome book. Yes. Carolyn, take it away. What do we have here?
A book by Dave Sim, all about self-publishing. Everything you'll need to know, plus more. But, you know, you don't have to go by the guide. Take it for what it is. It is great advice, though. And we're all going to sign it.
He wants it.
I want it.
You have to ask a really great question.
Yeah, so I guess...
Only one is available, and it's very special. Dave Sim signed in it, drew in it. He even wrote the name of our panel in it.
So. How are we going to decide? It's just going to be a group decision. Like, that's a great one, and that decision can happen
sort of
at any time.
Either, isn't it?
Yeah, we'll figure out who can get this book, but there's only one.
It'll be a spontaneous,
your brush is all dry
spontaneous up. Start.
Deathmatch.
Yeah. Oh. Deathmatch. I like deathmatches. So I guess the first question, I'm going to start the first question at the very beginning. Everyone here, was it, when you were growing up, was it your dream to work in comic books? To make comic books, per se?
Yes. Yes, I loved cartoons when I was growing up, and comics led me that way. You know, just to create characters and make a story, I feel like that's an important thing of who I am, so I wanted to be a cartoonist.
For me, it was the waterlogged box of comics at the flea market. There was no comic shop, there was no bookstore, there was no nothing in my town, and it was like that old story that starts with the guy in the turban that gives you the evil magic book that turns you into a werewolf, and then it's gone, and your mom throws the book out, and you're doomed to be a werewolf forever. Oh, no. But here's this weird little stall in the flea market, you know, with this guy who was closing up that day, giving up, throwing in the towel, and he just gave me a box of books, you know. I mean, there's a water stain halfway up the box, so the comics were in terrible shape. But, you know, in that I got ElfQuest number 13 and Cerebus number 52 and Miz Tree and Neil the Horse, and you know, he had all his indies in one box, and all the indies would fit in one box back then. And a Pacific catalog, Pacific Comics catalog, where I could get all the rest as it happened, which wasn't very much. And, you know, I had grown bored with the 7-Eleven comics that were available to me, and there was just something about it being black and white that made it seem possible. There was something about the four-color process, and even now with the much better computer processes now that put color on the comics, that removed it so far from my idea, I couldn't look at it and say, somebody drew that. Looking at the black and whites, I could see the ink strokes, and I started drawing, and that was really all there was to it.
I went to college for filmmaking, and I had spent most of my life believing, "Ooh, I'm going to be a grand filmmaker one day." And about 8 years post college, I came to this realization that there was a chance I was going to be doomed to be like an industrial filmmaker, or someone that made training videos for folks. And I thought, that's not what I really want to do. Deep inside, I'm a storyteller, and I've simply chosen film as the medium that I want to tell stories in, but I'm finding it difficult breaking into film. And I didn't want to go that route, so I made this kind of 8 year after college mid-course transition, and then spent a decade in the 90s as a self-publisher that you've never heard of. Lost Cause Productions, I did a book called Spandex Tights, Aerobic Superheroines. It was very, very sad, about 25 issues in the middle of the 90s. And then I thought I was leaving comics until Mike Oeming in the early aughts kind of pulled me back in with asking me to create his Mice Templar universe for him. And Mice Templars put me on the map, and now I'm doing both independent comics and mainstream comics, and that's the journey.
When I was 6, I was asked this question for an essay in school. What do you want to be when you grow up? And I had two answers. The first was farmer, and the second was trapeze artist. And I thought those were the two most awesome-sounding jobs in the world.
If you could combine them.
I didn't think about the fact that I was an artist and that I did like to draw and that I did like cartoons a whole lot and that might actually be a career as well. And I think it was when I was 9 that I finally realized, no, I definitely want to be a cartoonist. That's the end of my answer.
So once everyone decides to be a cartoonist, right on the bat, what was the one first thing that you discovered about, like, was it difficult for you? Was it something that you can easily jump into?
I discovered that writing punchlines was hard, and that's mostly because I was reading comic strips as my primary source of comics. And so the 3-panel or 4-panel and then punchline format was what I aspired to be when I was younger. And I was just terrible at writing jokes, and no one ever laughed at my jokes. So I had to figure something else out.
I found the actual the crafting of story is easy. Making it success is where it's very, very hard.
I was always confident that my art would get better because I could see which way to get into it. It was the writing that I always struggled with. So I always drew, but I kind of think I'm only learning how to write now. So, you know, you don't learn it without doing it, so I keep on doing it.
Yeah, again with the art, I feel like my art has gotten a million times better since I started constantly drawing. It's good if you draw every single day. I have a blog called Sketch Before Sleep, and I make effort to do an illustration every night. Sometimes you can tell I really just want to go to bed, and I do it. But I don't want to spend more than half an hour a day on it, but at least it's an exercise that breaks me up that is good to do just to say, hey, I did something every day.
That's a good question to run off, like transition into. Are there ever times where you're like, I can't do this today? What actually keeps you going? Is there anything where you're like, you look at a photo and you're like, oh, that's why I'm doing this, or you watch a movie? Like, what is actually your inspiration to keep making new work?
Do you have a trick for it?
I try to at least have a new book at every show I appear at. Sometimes it's hard in the fall because there's a lot of conventions every single weekend, but the goal is to do that, have something to premiere every time you make an appearance.
There are tricks. There's a million. Once you've used one a couple times, it doesn't work anymore. So you have to kind of, you know, you can't let pursuit of a trick push you too far. I mean, I even wrote a whole book about that trick in a way, because it's a book called Talisman, and it's about a little girl who falls in love with a book when she's too young to read it, and loses it when she's old, can't get it when she's old enough to actually read it, and spends the rest of her life essentially trying to recreate it. And she goes all over town telling herself she's not going to bother with this anymore. You know, she thinks she's a bad writer. There's no point in it. She's gonna create this blank book that's going to make her writing better. And she recognizes this is ridiculous. And she's only going to let herself go so far to do it. I did that. I'd made that exact book, and it's still sitting on my shelf with nothing in it. But it satisfied me that I got the sort of talismanic urges out of me. I was going to do my best not to fall in love with a material or a situation or a ritual, because it makes you a little too brittle if you have too much ritual. If you just have a material that you like, stick with it. But if you have to go all the way to Singapore to get it, find something else. Because it will handicap you. If you do not have that thing anymore, then you will be too anxious to work. Just grab whatever's handy and get back to work. If it looks a little bit different from yesterday's page, you're just going to have to live with it. But little things like, if I've got 20 pages to ink, sometimes I start at the back and ink backwards on pencils. Or you pick the panel with the cute girl in it, or whatever. You know, you do whatever it is to get you moving. But the main thing is, nobody who reads your book later is going to know you had a bad day that day, nor will they care. What matters is the book. So you have to be the one to figure out what little thing gets your jaw up off the floor so that you can work that day.
A lot of people are all about the process, and it's great. As artists, we love to figure out what is the meaning of this, or why did you draw this, and keeping all your sketches in a folder. And that's great and all for yourself, but at the end of the day, like, what matters is the printed book. No one else is really going to see your process unless you release that information online, whether it be a blog, or if you want to have a process blog, or show it in at the end of your book. But at the end of the day, your final product is your final product.
Can I take the second to get a little bit of crowd participation? At the count of three, can I have everyone say hi, Jimmy? 1, 2, 3.
Hi, Jimmy.
Hi, everyone. Sorry I'm late. Ran here, so I look like a nut job running through the building. Yeah.
No, that's awesome, though. What we're talking about is basically what keeps you going? What keeps you producing new work? Like, what's your inspiration? Or
The fear of death and not getting the story that I have in my head out is probably my number one motivation, because as I'm sure everybody here, it's like we have like these stories in our brain, and it's like a full parking lot, and until you pull one of them out, you can't put anything new in there. And it's not only, you know, again, half, you know, most of the stories, you know, will never see print, or they just don't make sense, or by the time you're working on it, somebody actually made a film or another book that's the same exact idea. Mm-hmm. So those get shuffled away and destroyed. We trash those quickly. But it's basically, you know, I have these stories I want to tell. I'm not getting any younger. I better get to work. And the people I admire, the guys like Stephen King, who I keep, every time I go to bookstores, another book, I'm like, oh, look at that guy. You know, the
and
people
he nearly died.
What's that?
And he nearly died.
My car almost.
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, you know, that was me driving a car, by the way. I just can't keep up with that guy. But anyway, yeah, so it's that kind of stuff. I mean, I think it's just born in us that we want to, with storytellers, and like I always say, we're good listeners. So yeah, so the idea that I'm not going to get them out is very frustrating.
I just try to keep up with other artists and other creators, and when I see that peers of mine or people I'm a fan of are producing work on a pretty frequent basis, I'm like, I need to catch up. But also just seeing how wonderful their work is really inspires me, and reading, I mean, something new, something old, something I love. Whatever it is, if it's great, I'll be inspired by it. It kicks my butt to want to work harder and work better.
Yeah, I tend to work on things that I myself would like to read, and the things that I the media that I like to take in, it needs to either make me think or it needs to stir my emotion in some way. So a lot of times I find the emotion of what I'm writing to be pretty important, and then I maneuver the other aspects of the story to support that emotion. So as part of a process, if I'm having difficulty one day, I'll actually, my wife sees, I get into the emotion of whatever scene that I'm writing, because I feel if it strikes emotionally true, that's the thread that people are going to cue in on. So a lot of times I'll write to movie soundtracks, and if I'm having a hard time getting started, I'll put on music that I feel fits the mood of the scene, of the emotional state I want to get in to write that scene. And then once that pump has been primed, usually then I transition from emotion to emotion to scene, and it all begins to flow pretty well.
I think that's a really good point. I think that sometimes when you get stuck on a story and you just really, it really feels like work to work on the next scene or whatever, it's often because there's something missing, or you've lost the thread of the story that you're trying to get out. And if it's become boring to you, it's very easy to get wound around the axle and start moaning about how a horrible person you are and you're a fraud and everybody will know it. But the fact is, there's something wrong with what you're doing sometimes. I mean, if it's because you don't really want to draw the Eiffel Tower from the inside because of all the perspective, then that's fine. You're just going to have to suck that up and do it. SketchUp. But just the same, if it's a whole section of the story you just don't want to be bothered with anymore, it's inevitably, well, not inevitably, but often because you've just gotten sideways on the story somehow, or a character's gone wrong, or the mood. And then it's whatever does it. I listen to movies when I work because albums are too short. I want conversation in the background that I don't actually have to answer.
I see you're the first one. Now, remember, you could win that book.
Are we going to rate the questions after they're asked and answered?
Shouldn't.
We should
have an
Olympic judging. That sounds
pretty scary. So what's your question is?
Do you find any perks or drawbacks from being your particular sex in the industry that you work in?
No.
My penis gets in the way.
No.
Being you, Jenny.
Yeah. It happens.
My boobs are sometimes too big.
That's sometimes.
They fluctuate. It used to make a difference in mainstream comics, and it's a different world now. Raina, when you and I started in comics, it was a girl, but it's just not like that anymore. And I recently did a 6-page story for Marvel for a three issue anthology called Girl Comics, and the internet pooped its pampers over that name. Oh, it's ghettoizing, it's marginalizing. Well, the paycheck was really big.
And it's a great book.
And a lot of editors from Marvel and a couple from DC sent me little emails saying, hey, that was a great story. If you're ever interested in blah, 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 let us know. That's not marginalizing. That's not the ghetto. That's opportunity. Yeah, if it had a name that made people, go shriek, screech, well, so what?
Yeah, I don't think people look at the work. Like, the editors, they don't care. They look at the work. And it's funny because for art, it's easier because they see it and they go, I want that or I don't. And,
right.
And they don't even know who's behind it. They don't even care. If it's something they want, they go after it. The writing's a little tougher because, they don't really read submissions too much. But but definitely if you're an artist, and if you're writing and doing your own work, it's just the work that speaks for itself. And it might have been different way back when, but not, I don't think anymore.
And it's not different at all in indies. Mm-hmm. At all. In the mainstream, sometimes, I hear stories every once in a while, but in the indies, no. It's a free and open world.
And in the book publishing industry, like, the whole book publishing industry is pretty much run by
women.
Yeah. So, I barely even see guys when I walk around.
Your editor will be some graduate from Sarah Lawrence.
Except my editor.
Being a white male over the age of 40, I need all the help I can get in the industry right now.
Well, it's a sex change. You can have a sex change.
There you go.
Brianna Glass. This is actually kind of a good segue into my question, which is, for those of you who have worked, who have self-published and worked with editors, I'd be curious for a compare-contrast. What's good about working with an editor, what's challenging?
I started self-publishing as a mini comics artist, and I did that for about 5 years before I started working with Scholastic. And I mean, the kinds of stories I was doing for Scholastic were very similar to the mini comics stories. They were personal stories, they were autobiographical stories. It's very hard to edit autobio, so I mean, an editor can weigh in and say the story arc is there or it's not, but if this is your life story that you're telling, it's hard for them to really say, yeah, change the ending completely. And now I'm working on a fiction story, so it's been a little bit of a different experience, a lot of rewriting, but I'm okay with that. Like, I'm okay with rewriting if it means the story is going to be better in the end. And I think with self-publishing, you can just write it, draw it, and then publish it. Mm-hmm. With an editor, there's a lot more steps in between.
I found with Mice Templar, the immediate creative team is the editorial, and there's a lot of times there's a freedom that comes with it, but after the fact, you look back at some things you did in some issues, some panels, some sequences, and you go, oh man, this book would have benefited if I'd had an editor. But now that I'm doing some more mainstream with Marvel, I'm applying a lot of how the editors are working with me and trying to self-apply that to the independent work that I'm doing. And I believe that the new work is showing signs of improvement.
Having an editor is terrific if you're not completely sure of the story that you're doing. Having an editor is a complete pain in the butt if you're very sure of the story that you're doing. A really good editor is one who cares. And sometimes a good editor who cares will get out of your way, and sometimes a good editor who cares will micromanage you to death. It's a little bit like being nuzzled to death. But, for example, the girl comic story that I did, it was basically two mutants walk into a bar, haha. A lot of simple-minded jokes about what kind of drink any given superhero would drink. Har, hardy, har, har, barking spider for Gwen Stacy, yuck, yuck. And then I find out that the book is intended for a teen audience, and that automatically made it mature material, the fact that they were in a bar drinking alcohol. And so my editor said, look, I can make this work if there's some other context to the story, so that if somebody comes back and says, isn't this a shocking treatise on teaching teenagers how to drink? She can say, why no? It's a poignant growing up story, and I have the papers to prove it. And she was right. She was right. Helping you aim your story at an audience is sometimes a useful exercise. Not always. Because when you think of a story and you get excited about it, you never think about the audience. You never think about it. And in a way, you shouldn't. Not at the outset, because, you can cut off whole hunks of worthwhile story vibe in order to say, oh, this should be a, 17-year-old goth girls, or whatever, and narrow your story down too much. But once you've really got it slapped into shape and it's ready to be expanded upon, a good editor can be really useful, if only to play the role of your friend who says, I don't get it. The person who says, I see what you mean to do with this story or this scene or this line or whatever, but if you did it this way, it'd be better. That one really excitable friend you have that you put your work in front of them, they say, oh, that's so cool, because I can tell that if this happens, this and this and this and this and this, and what happens next? That's often a very good motivator in and of itself, a really intuit editor. They're a super reader. Good ones. Who write for you and your story?
Well, I self-publish everything with Curl Studio, and so I'm my own editor, which can be difficult, but also you know that your creation is fully on yourself, and
there's to blame.
No one else to blame, and you get the full control, which is really nice to have. And then just recently we did an anthology with some artists that we cherry-picked that we liked. So in that instance, I did get to work with other writers, and I was like, I guess as editor of this project, I totally gave complete control and free rein. There was a few spelling errors that I corrected, but...
That's good. God bless you.
But besides,
I'm sorry.
But besides that, I really just wanted it to be a fun project, and I wanted the artists to have fun with it since Curl Studio was publishing it, so... I just wanted to get out everyone's name together. So it's good to work with other artists and writers that you know of, And put together your own anthology if you want to self-publish that, and it gets everyone's name out at once. And I felt it was an extreme benefit to work with other artists, and some of the artists in here are like people that have worked with Top Cow, Kenneth Rocafort, or Rafael Navarro. He's an animation storyboard artist for his daytime job, mm-hmm. and he does amazing artwork as well. And also Elizabeth Waddison,
Yay!
Who did Charm School. It's one of my books that I got drawn into comics in college. Mm-hmm. So it was good to work with her, and she's back in comics now
Yay!
Because of this book. So I really am excited about doing that and working with other artists in that instance, and other Aww. Artists and writers. So I would suggest getting friends together and creating a book and making your own anthology as well. So you don't have to like be necessarily working with a top, you know, big two or three, you know, publishers. You can totally do it yourself and approach publishers later on, especially once you learn your ropes for like the first few years. It definitely
Absolutely.
Helps you make mistakes before you hit it big time.
For me, an editor has to earn my respect. When I start with a new editor, what comes out of his mouth, I actually look at and read and say, this guy has no idea what he's talking about, or he does. I mean, and you get it. On Jonah Hex, I've been writing it with Justin now for 5 years. We got 60 issues out, and we've had 5 editors. And every time a new guy comes
wow.
in, it's almost like we break in editors on that book. And
you're just going to break them.
Yeah, well, no, they move on to greener pastures. But what happens is that, you know, they want to come in and they have excitement, but they want to change everything. And I always have to remind them, I'm like, there's a reason we got to issue 60. So let's work together. So, you know, it's an interesting process. Now, a great editor will look at your script and say, there's a flaw here. Or you dropped something and you didn't pick it up later. And that's what a great editor will do. Will point out something that you might have missed. In the excitement of writing it, your story goes off base. You know, you're watching, you're following the spine, and all of a sudden you go off this way. A great editor will be there to pull you in. I have been very fortunate, but I've had a couple of editors that were frustrated writers and would take stuff I've done and say, wouldn't it be cool if this guy did this, or if Jonah Hex cried and then he laughed, and I'm like, what? What are you talking about, you know? And editors that want to be writers, I understand it, and I get it, but I have to also remind them that, you know, I got hired to write it, and let's find a happy medium. So yeah, it's a very delicate balance, because if you're completely rude to them, then they don't want to work with you, and then they'll fight you on everything. It's a very interesting relationship. It could be very, very beneficial, especially when you're starting, to have somebody with experience be able to point stuff out. But the stuff I've self-published, I have Amanda Connor in the other room. And Amanda is fantastic. I take whatever I do, and I bring it to her, and she'll be the first one to rip me a new hole. She'll go, this is terrible. I don't get that. What's going on there? And I totally respect her for it, and I love her for it, because she definitely is looking at it with a fresh eye, and she doesn't care who I am. And it's the perfect relationship in that respect. So having somebody that has no problem telling you how it really is even good. You know, it's a good thing when you're self-publishing, because you're in your own head.
It's crucial.
You just want to tell a story, and then you realize, like, what the hell, you know. And I think you mentioned earlier, you write the stories for yourself. And it is, because if you're laughing at it, you think, well, everybody else will. But then you realize that, you know, I have a sick sense of humor. A guy falling down 50 flights of stairs is funny to me. You know, where another person's calling 911 and getting an ambulance, I'm giggling, you know. So you understand that what you kind of trying to say may not relate.
That's when you do a webcomic.
yeah, exactly. So editors can be great, or they can be a complete disaster, but they have to earn my respect, and that's how I treat all of them, pretty much.
You served the hat.
Hi. That's a good segment to the question that I had. This is coming from the viewpoint of someone who's just writing his first script. I haven't self-published anything. I'm just writing a script. When you show your scripts to people, would you trust someone's opinion who's more steeped in traditional literature background, or someone who just likes comics, for lack of a better phrase? And I mean trust them on the quality of the storytelling.
You know, quality, you mean the mathematics of the storytelling. You're talking about the actual...
Is this a good story? Does this hold me? Am I interested
in general?
Okay,
in general, you might have to use a couple of people, because if... some people say I don't like romantic movies. We've all read movie reviews where the first thing is, I generally don't like horror movies. And I really don't read it after that, because I'm like, you know, if you don't like horror movies, why are you reviewing this horror movie? You know, don't tell me, you know. So I think a couple of people's opinion out of the gate might be okay for you to do. Obviously, people you respect, and also take their opinions and decipher it. Don't take it word for word. Just look through it. You know, it's like meeting a girl in a bar. You know, you know, take it for what it is. Listen to the words, what they're really saying, and pull what you know. It's gonna have to come back to you. You're gonna have to either say, I never go all in with anybody's opinion, only because again, it's an opinion. You know. Even guys I insanely respect, I listen to, and I'm like, okay, but it takes me a day or two to actually figure out, maybe, why would they think that? And then I have to process it. So you have to kind of figure out. And again, he might be 100% right 2 days later in your head. But at the time, you're like, no, you know, you just don't like it. You know, we've all, you know, been there. So, I mean, that's how I would process it.
Well, I think what I can add to that is it sounds like what you're concerned about is your audience. Whether the people who you're going to put this under their noses, whether they're going to get it. So are you writing for literary comics, or are you writing for fun comics, or somewhere in between? What it sounds like what you're concerned about is the structure of the story and whether or not it's going to come across. Well, for that, you need feedback, which is what we're all saying. You know, find some people who are into, you know, various things and stick it under their nose and see what they say. And a lot of people will say, I don't like to read scripts.
I think no matter what type of person you're asking, just make sure they're the type of person that can articulate why they do or don't like something. Because if someone says to you, I didn't like this, and you ask them why, and they're like, I don't know, I just didn't, that's kind of useless. Yeah. I mean, that's a valid answer, but it's good to be able to understand why or why not.
That's my old relationships. Why are you mad?
I don't know.
I'm just mad. I'm like, why? Yeah.
The first person that takes a look at anything that I do is my wife, who comes from a professional editorial background, but knows nothing about comics. So she's able to look at the work that I do and immediately kind of process it from that literary standpoint. Without bringing all the baggage of comics and years of continuity with the Marvel work that I'm doing, none of that means anything to her. So as long as it's telling a self-contained story that she can comprehend and follow, so she's my very first sounding board for everything that I do. And then after that, you test out here's the comic audience, here's the snooty literary audience, here's the video game audience, and as Jimmy said, you then process. And if someone has a negative reaction, and then they tell you why they had a negative reaction, you can internalize it and realize, ooh, you know what, the data they gave, they're actually wrong. But for some reason, their gut reaction was they didn't like it. So you analyze, what was it that gave that gut reaction? If your story requires all of these very subtle clues in order to validate what you've done, you've kind of missed your audience there.
So I have a hard question, actually. I don't know if it's hard or not, but it's a question I've always wanted to know. Do you guys have any, I guess, hard lessons from selling your books or pitching them or trying just to get them out in the world? Like, were any first rules you're like, oh, I shouldn't, you know, say this, or...
Don't sleep with the editors.
When you're self-publishing and you're writing essentially for yourself, this happens to so many people, including me. When you're sitting on the other end of the table, smiling brightly and, you know, thinking about your hotel bill, it's very hard to make your book sound really exciting to the first person who walks up and says, hey, it looks cool, what's it about? When you start from the, you know, from the work-for-hire point of view, you know what the story is about because you're given a project. You know, you're supposed to write a story about a doctor who finds a cure for psychopaths, and the psychopaths, once cured, are so filled with remorse and horror at how horrible their lives are that they kill it. Ta-da! You can sum that up in 10 words or less. I know it's a reductionist, annoying Hollywood way of going about a story, but once the story's done, you've got to be able to make it sound interesting to sell it to people. If they get it and they find out that it isn't exactly like the 10 words or less that you gave, they're still interested. They're not going to come back and hit you with the book just because it was a little bit different from what you said about it, but it's best to try and come up with your little sales haiku that sums up the book and makes it sound interesting. That's crucial, and it's something I've always been very bad at.
I'm going to try a haiku.
I'm going to run on Carla's sort of answer to the question, and I think the question is now being interpreted as advice to exhibiting at cons, perhaps. Be friendly. Do be very, very friendly, and smile at people as much as possible. And I'm not just saying that to promote my book, Smile.
Don't sit like this behind the table.
Right, but
glare at people if they don't buy
things. I am not a huge fan of people standing in front of their table with something to hand out for free and saying, free thing, free thing, free thing, for like 3 days straight. Because the people passing by are on overload already. And if they hear you saying that, they're just going to be like, no, no, don't talk to me. So it's like a weird balance somewhere in between.
Another thing is mentally, when you're giving somebody a free pamphlet, they think that they already got something
right.
from you. So they're done at your table, and they're just going to walk on by.
Give them the freebie after you talk to them.
Or have a sign on your table that says, free thing, and let them come to you. Mm-hmm. And then you can point them to that.
Go ahead. The
other thing is, like, when I knew I wanted to make comics, I knew I wanted to create characters and do this whole thing. When I first went to Small Press Expo, I went for 2 years just as a spy to totally check it out. I volunteered, I got in for free, and I was looking around, and I was like, I totally want to do this. This is awesome. Because I live in the D.C. area, in Bethesda, Maryland. Try to go to SPX. It's every fall. And I prepared myself for it, but then being behind the table the first time, it's so different. Like, how many people in the audience have actually been behind the table and sold work?
You know we don't wear pants, right?
Okay. So it's about 50%. It's so different, the mindset, to be behind the table. Definitely do not be shy. I took improv classes last summer, and that totally helped me just talk to people. I know it sounds silly, but
smart.
You need to break your shell.
It's great for writing, too.
Yeah, it's great for writing as well, and it just makes you so much more creative. And, like, my first few conventions, I didn't know what to do. I didn't know how to talk to people, and I thought we were just supposed to sit and sketch or something. Like, I was like, so am I just supposed to do artwork behind here? But it's all about selling. It's all about talking to people. And usually, most of the time, like, really 75% of the time that I have a conversation with somebody, they end up buying something, which is really good odds. So having a conversation with somebody helps so much. Your first impression with somebody helps so much. And even meeting somebody for 5 minutes, and I will see them every year, and they'll come back to my table, that means so much to me. And it's only a 5-minute ordeal that I'll see them once a year.
Yeah. Ordeal is a good word.
Stand
up occasionally so your neck won't hurt.
Yeah, do some stretches.
Well, it's important because you think about it. These people are meeting you for maybe a minute or two. It might be the only time they ever meet you. So their impression of you lasts a lifetime. Okay, so if you're rude, if you're ignoring them, if you're on your cell phone in front of them, they're like, eh, dick, you know, and they move on to the next table. And that impression is very important because I remember when I used to go to cons, and I still remember a couple of guys were just like, you know, I'll never forget those guys because they were like really nice to me, and then the people who weren't. And,
right.
You know, you have to be genuine. You look them in the face. You speak to them. If you see it, they wear a badge. I like to call them by their name all the time. I go, hey, Bob, good to see you again. And they're like, you know me? You know. But be personable. It's only a couple hours a day. And it's honestly, these are people supporting your work. And if you make a friend, and if you make somebody, if you can have a conversation, I like to ask people what they do for a living because I'm genuinely interested what other people do for a living. And this kind of stuff sticks with people. And a quick segue, when John F. Kennedy ran for office, he had a guy that stood next to him the whole time. And every time John F. Kennedy met somebody in every state, this guy had a photographic memory, go back and write down who it is and what the conversation was. And every time John F. Kennedy came into a new town, a year later, he'd see somebody, and the guy would talk to him, and he'd go, "Hey, Bob, how's little Gina? Is she feeling any better since?" And that's it. Guy was sold. That was it. John F. Kennedy was the greatest man that ever lived. He remembered my daughter. And these are little techniques, and they don't have to be, like, you have to be genuine while you're doing them, okay?
Yeah.
But what I'm saying is that it's people. It's one-on-one contact. We're writing stories. They're reading your stories. So this minute is so important to it. So don't blow it off. Don't hang out with your buddies. Don't talk on a cell phone. I try not to eat in front of people, and we can't leave the table, but I go, Amanda and I go under the table and we eat, because I don't like to sit there and go, so anyway, you know. And, I mean, it's just proper etiquette, but these are the people that will be supporting you for the rest of your life.
There are some people that take pictures of cartoonists eating, so beware.
Yeah.
You serve the hat. You've had your hand up for a while.
Yeah, say you've just finished the first issue of your comic and you're going to the Comic Con and you want to give this free copy to as many people and editors and stuff as possible. And say you see Stan Lee walking down the hall, would you recommend going up directly, actively to people and giving them...
Tackle,
absolutely.
He's an old man, tackle.
He runs fast.
His legs will snap. And you have them for an hour.
I haven't met an editor yet that could run fast. But no, seriously, though, that's a wonderful tactic. I brought about 100 copies of my first, copy shop comic back in 19-diggity-whatever. And I went to San Diego, which was a quarter the size that it is now, and I wandered around like an ant after honey, finding every pro that I could find who was there, whose work I really loved and it inspired me, and it was a great calling card. You could say, "Hi, Mr. So-and-so, I love your work here, I hope you love mine," and then run away. And of that 100-something copies of the book that I set out, you know, I'm sure most people didn't read them, but those that did, of those that did, 6 people sent me terrific letters.
Wow.
Charles Vest, Donna Barr, Dave Sim, hell, even Gerhard sent me a letter, and he doesn't write. And not only did I treasure those letters, and Charles Vest crammed so much text onto the back of a postcard, it's unbelievable, but he actually offered me critique that was really, really useful. But on the business side of things, now I had 6 support letters from known pros that I could impress other people with, including distribution. And so, A, it was fun for me. B, it was good feedback in some cases. C, it gave me some quotes that I could put on a book to impress other people with. I swear, I think my only customers were other professionals for years.
I will say, don't interrupt the editor if he's talking to somebody else. Like, use proper etiquette. Chasing Stan Lee, not the way to do it, okay? But honestly, if he's talking to somebody, don't interrupt them, because then you're the annoying guy.
Or eating.
Or in the bathroom. I've had that happen. At a urinal, and the guy's like, "Hey, Jimmy Palmiotti, how are you?" It's like 2 urinals over. And I'm like, "Hey, how are you doing? You know, like, what's going on here?" You know, and I'm like, "Hey, the tile floor is kind of cold,
awesome,
huh?" You know? But yeah, it, you know, there's places you kind of got to be cool about it, you know?
Aww.
My advice is going to kind of be contrary to your perspective.
Aww.
No, in a good way. about 5 years ago when I was getting back into the industry, I thought, I actually want to be the guy that reads every single sample that gets brought to my table. I want to be able
to
interact with the fellow creators. That's how I met Carolyn. Mm-hmm. And... it worked really, really well until I started finding I was leaving every convention with an entire box of stuff.
But the box of swag's the best part.
Yeah, but it would get to a point where when you're doing a dozen shows and traveling, next thing I knew, at home, I had more boxes in my office of samples that people had given to me than the boxes of stuff that I kind of needed to read professionally or that I wanted to read. And I just, like, I looked at it one day and just did the math and went, oh, I really didn't want to become this guy, but
library.
The amount of time in a day, I have donated a ton of things.
The Hyatt cleaning staff has the biggest library of comic books after San Diego. They're the biggest, because you can't take all this stuff overseas.
Yeah.
I mean, you literally get hundreds sometimes, and you're like, oh my God, I feel so bad, and they're all signed to you.
Yeah.
You know, and you're like,
Yeah, so now it's become a real... I'm a little more selective, and sometimes I'll let the aspiring creator know. Like they'll hand me something, and I'll say, "Ooh, I know this cost you a lot of money to produce. I've got to be honest with you. It's going to go in a box of stuff that I'm probably not going to look at." And some creators have looked at me and gone, "Oh, there's a jerk." Other have looked and said, "Wow, I really appreciate your honesty there." So it's going to come down to what your one-on-one interaction with people are.
That's what strikes you.
Yeah.
Yeah. You serve the glasses.
Yeah, I was wondering if you could all talk about, I'm an aspiring comic artist and really looking to get into the industry, and I was wondering if you could talk about that terrifying moment of deciding to quit your day job and, you know, devote yourself to your work.
I didn't quit my day job until I had enough work to sustain me. That took about 5 years from when I started making mini comics to when Scholastic needed my books on 6-month deadlines, and it was just impossible for me to work a part-time job even. So I've been freelance for 5 years since.
I was working advertising for Franklin Mint when you used to get those little adverts in your TV guides.
The Hildebrand sword.
Yes.
The Civil War chess set.
Yeah, the Lord of the Rings chess set. Yeah, I was somewhat involved with those. And I was laid off, and this a year into the layoff, like, whoa, okay, this is getting bad, they finally announced they would not be bringing me back. I'm like, oh, great, okay, well, I got to do something. And I had spent that year laid off just totally focusing on, I want to begin the serious transition into writing. If comics aren't open to me, how can I break into prose writing? And my wife and I, we had heard an interview with Dean Koontz about how he had transitioned from being a school teacher to his wife gave him 5 years to make it as a writer. And we listened to the interview, and it was pretty cool. And about 3 days later, while I'm like looking at the job classified ads, my wife just walked in and said, "That Dean Koontz interview has been rolling around in my brain, so I know you're not going to be a slouch, but if Dean Koontz's wife could do that for him, I will give you 5 years." And within 5 years of that, my Templar was out. I had my first novel out. And
and you bought your wife some cookies.
Absolutely. She gets the best cookies.
Five years is not a bad yardstick. I come from a small business background. All of my family either are independent professionals or small business people. And they all said, all right, it's not digging ditches or clipping poodles, but if you can do it for 5 years and pour back every penny you make back into it, my advice, learn to cook, because those ramen noodles get old after a while. They really do. And you can survive cheaper on food that you cook. You really can. If you can plow it all back in for 5 years, if after 5 years it ain't working, you got to do something else, kid. Here's your seed money. Blam. That's what they did for me, and my husband and I both started business at the same time. Here's a hint, don't start businesses at the same time. just don't. But we lived in a shoebox, and I did nothing, essentially, but sit in the middle of my bed with a lap board because there wasn't room for a table in my little apartment and work. And that's how the first 5 or 6 issues of my book got done. But 5 years isn't a bad yardstick. You get a job that you can do part-time for a while, eventually you've just got to make a leap. But luckily, this is not like Social Security. They won't cut off your benefits, you know, if they find out that you're making too much money on the side. One thing, though, the thing to remember when you're in that phase, when you've started to make a little money but it's not quite enough to live on yet, is now is the time to really hone your work process, because that will always be changing. One thing for sure, you will never have enough time and you will never have enough money. Because once you're a full-time artist and you're thinking, sweet, you know, I've got my money rolling in, I got to juggle jobs, but that's, you know, I can deal with that. Then you're going to have kids. Or God forbid, one of your parents is going to get sick. Or God forbid, you're going to get sick. I had carpal tunnel for a couple of years, surgery, it was awesome. But just the same, something's going to happen to mess with your process so that you're not getting as much work done as you need to. Find something that can be shaved out of your process. You'd be surprised sometimes how much faster you can get and still do good work. very important for that transitional stage.
Well, I'm probably the only one here who actually still has a day job.
The smart one.
I work as a designer full-time, and I do not sleep doing comics. Because, I come home, I do my comics, I do my sketch before sleep, I have everything that I need to do, and I promote, and I'm on Twitter and Facebook promoting my artwork as well. So at the same time, okay, so I'm working a 40-hour week job as a designer, and I do a lot of like stuff for the Air Force, which is actually pretty cool stuff. But then also at the same time, I'm getting a lot of freelance illustration gigs. Like right now, I'm doing something for National Geographic, and then at the same time, I'm trying to get my comics out, and I'm self-publishing my comics, and I love doing the comics. Like that's what I live for. So I love working at night. Like, my really good hours are midnight to 2 a.m. That I'm really creative during those times. Basically, just work really hard. And for the long... I would say to keep your day job as long as possible. Mm-hmm. Until you really can't, like... If you get so huge, you cannot deal with working anymore. If, you know, just... if that day comes, then that would be a lovely day. So you really just have to just keep working and maintain a schedule that's still doable.
Yeah, that's great advice, because you don't want to go cold turkey when you have no money. When I went out of college, I went into advertising, and I started in an agency. And by the time I hit 30, I was one of the three partners of owning it. And on my 30th birthday, literally the next day, I went in and quit, and they sold off my third of the company. And I said, I want to do comics on my 30th birthday. That was my birthday present to myself, because I want to do something else with my life. And I started doing backgrounds for Mark Texera, because he was a buddy from high school, and he was doing Ghost Rider. And I started doing all the backgrounds, and every truck in the background had Palmiotti's Pickles, every street was Palmiotti's Street, whatever. And it took me a while. And I went from making a hell of a lot of money to making around $200 a week, but I was smart. When I had my job, I saved a lot of money. And again, that came from not ever having money when I was a kid. And so it took a long time. I mean, it was a gradual thing. I mean, I've inked over 1,000 books before I started writing stuff. You know, and the writing stuff is when I started self-publishing with Event Comics. So, on some way, I've always made sure I had a net. That if I take a risk with something, even my writing, I said, well, I'm going to try the writing, but I can always ink a book to pay the rent if I have to. Mm-hmm. So I kind of like, I've been very lucky, you know, and I took what I learned in advertising and applied it to this field, which helps, which, you know, all you guys probably, in a way, it helps business-wise. But I think your advice is dead on. It's like, don't give up the job. Just do it until you can't do it anymore. Until one starts winning out the other one. That's probably... Look how crappy the economy is. I mean, you got to be smart right now.
Yeah.
You serve the hat.
Hey, my name's Chris. I'm an upstate New York animator. I've been animating my own cartoons, writing, and directing for about 4 years now. I started my own business up there, and it's just so intense. I work like 14 hours a day, and I'm broke. And I love making stuff. I love creating. I have a small team that I totally love. But I just wonder if any of you guys have any words of wisdom, anything that, I don't know, did you walk into a meeting and just get it? Did you make a relationship that brought you somewhere? I'm so exhausted every day, and I just want to know, hey, you guys made it.
Oh, yeah. I got a question. How long have you been doing it for?
I've been animating in Flash for 11 years, but I've been out of college for about 4.
And when you Flash animation, have you picked up clients to use your Flash animation? Okay. Do you have a steady group of clients?
No, I'd say I have maybe 2 or 3 animation gigs. I just finished a job yesterday for an animated website.
Okay, and you have a website of your own that features all the other work that you've done for these companies?
Oh, yeah, most of it.
Okay, and do you send them out to other companies to get new work?
No.
Okay, first thing.
Where do I go?
Okay, well, it's funny because you look at something like the iPad, and then you look at the ads on the iPads, and they're Flash animation, a lot of them. And you look at all these clients. So we're talking about advertising agencies, because that's where the clients go to get this kind of work. So there's there's in the especially with the internet now, you can look up the top 100 ad agencies, let's say. And in each one of these agencies, in each one of these sites, there will be a thing that says editor, or editor-in-chief, or associate editor, or talent, or editorial, blah, blah, blah. You get these emails. Once you build your site with a sample of all your work, including the advertising work, okay, that site is your business card. It's going to speak for you because you're not there to speak for yourself. They're going to look at it, and they see something in there that they like, and you send a nice letter with the link to the site, so it's easy for them. So they can just go click, 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 okay? Mm-hmm. And your contact information, your phone number, where you're always accessible by, you know, your cell, let's say. And this is the only way you're going to move your business forward. Right now, what you're doing is you're doing your work, and you got a couple of guys here, and all you guys are hanging out, and you're like saying, look how cool this is, and look how cool that is. But the reality is, you're going to grow by gaining clients. Your work is going to grow. So you need to do that right away. And you need to build your website. For a bunch of guys that do animation, I'm sure you can do a killer website.
Yeah.
Okay?
Everybody else.
Right. And it can't be you and your buddies jerking each other off, to be quite literal. Okay? You can't do that.
Too internet.
Right. You have to approach it professionally, clean, and sharp. And you want to know how you do that? You go to other websites where you see some animation done, where the successful studios are. Look at their intro. Look at their gateway website. That's what yours should be. Clean, professional, and exciting. You got a minute to woo somebody. You only got a minute. Then they'll get off the site. Okay? That's how you're going to get to your next step. Okay? I mean, that's as simple as I can tell you.
The only thing I can add is the longer you last, the luckier you get. It was 10 years publishing before any of the other publishers like Dark Horse or Image came around and courted me. 10 years, but they did. And I am going to be publishing through Dark Horse next year. And they're all excited. They're just jumping up and down and creating, you know, a new website and maps and all the little ding-dong stuff that people just love. And they call me up and say, we want to do this and we want to do that and we want to do the other. And I say, great. And they say, can you draw it? And I say, no. And they say, okay. And they go away and they do it themselves. It's terrific. But that happened after 10 years of the slog. So hang in.
So I think we have 1 minute, so I think let's go give away that book.
How?
What, can we decide for how we can give away the book?
Maybe you should come up with a number and whoever calls it out.
like a Chris Angel style?
Yeah, it gives everybody like level of playing field.
37.
You know what I mean?
Wait, so
I'm done with the money.
Is it like one united number and then someone's
going to... No, I think, you know. Pick somebody. Go ahead.
We could just hear the questions without giving them answers.
Yeah, really. Oh dear, we should have had that planned out.
Hey, who in the room is insecure?
Yeah,
who's insecure? Who's insecure about their work? Show of hands. Who's a little insecure? That's it. Everybody else knows what they're doing. I'm shocked. I just always ask that question because it always blows.
All right.
Who here has a comic book already out and is insecure? Everyone.
Who really wants
four.
This?
Okay.
Who's willing to kill another person to get this book?
Maybe we should take those out because you know, really, there is no one book with all the answers.
Wait a minute. Here's the real question. Who's going to buy everyone's book on this stage?
There you go.
Let's do the hat in the back
right,
first.
Down to three. We're down to three.
Okay.
I like this.
Anybody up for Irish clog dancing? I don't know.
I am back to Brooklyn.
There you go. Yeah, you don't have to buy anything. T-shirts.
I have no way. Someone.
You're in charge. You got to just handle your question.
That's a good
gal.
I was actually writing the questions down.
If it is.
Oh, you do? Writing
questions?
Yeah, all right.
I wrote the questions.
There you go. Let's do it.
Okay, who's got a really innovative idea for promoting a comic or a web comic? Who wants to stand up and talk?
Yeah.
Oh,
and
stand.
Turn it back.
Hop up.
Okay.
Project.
All right. Hi.
Hi.
I had this idea of doing something where you break down the fourth wall of the comic and involve the actual people who created the comic in the marketing aspect. So, like, maybe the creator is having a conversation with the character. Mm-hmm. And the character's like, no, I don't like this. Why did you write that? I would never do something like that.
Okay, so that would be, for example, a website, or would that be a comic itself?
To promote the comic itself, but that would just be kind of something that would show up on YouTube every now and then.
Okay.
Okay, well, that's fun. Who else has got one?
Stan? Well, to promote my new book, Golden Girl, I'm going to have a professional costume maker build a costume, and I'm going to have a model, Spunk's model, in front of our booth next year to promote it, because who's going to read this? I got to have some gimmick to draw somebody to the table.
So you're going to have a pretty girl in a costume?
Yep.
Okay. Who's got another one? Animation guy.
I'm standing. Hi. So I'm doing a series of DJ mixtapes to promote a character and a story that I'm writing, DJ Cutman. So I have a series of mixtapes with a narrative written into the mixtapes, like through samples from movies and stuff like that.
Okay.
And then I'm simultaneously releasing the story on my blog, so you can listen to the mixtape and let them read chapters on the blog. So there's like a music component, a graphic component, and then the written component online. Yeah.
Okay.
Sure. One of the things that I did to promote my webcomics is to link my blog, Facebook, Twitter, everything all into one site. So every time I update a page, boom, the webcomic is right out there in people's faces.
Okay. That's a good idea.
And I draw one of the best orc porn webcomics, hands down.
But you know what? I think that they're all different.
I've had to read those things.
You've got to use them for different audiences. Like, certain people are going to follow you on Facebook, and certain people are going to follow you on Twitter. So maybe, I don't know. I feel like you should adjust how you promote to each one.
Well, normally I do.
Okay.
It depends.
You split personalities.
Yeah.
Right?
You've got to split personalities.
There you go.
So is this Sergey the missing in the book?
I think she gets booked for the orc porn.
We're handing out the best
orc porn now.
Who is the person that asked about the traditional background in comics, or is this a good story?
Fellow right there.
There you go.
Yeah.
Sir, you are the chosen.
But, you know, Jimmy still has to sign it. But you're the chosen one.
Jimmy, you're the chosen one. There you go, everybody. This is my favorite question.
Get the book.
Thank you. That is the other side of the table.
Thank you all very much.
Thank you. I have books for
sale. Hey, comics!
Here at the table.
Thank you.
I like work more.
Thanks, everybody.
If you enjoyed The Other Side of the Table, log on to Facebook and search for The Other Side of the Table. You can join our group, and we can continue the discussion there. Thanks.